Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
As protesters march, chant, and even fight in Greece, taped from within the hour, this is becoming a big week for what may be really big news on the economy. The austerity plan vote just taken by the parliament in Greece today among those angry street protests could determine the fate of multiple banks and even countries in Europe and ripple all the way to safer money market funds in the United States. The huge new settlement between Bank of America and Countrywide, which it owns, and some of its biggest mortgage securities clients could be the most significant step since the financial crisis began towards stabilizing American banks and therefore the U.S. housing market and therefore the broader economy, according to economists quoted by the New York Times today. And today is the second to last day of the Federal Reserve Board's quantitative easing, or QE2 program, to flood the country with easy money and try to stimulate the economy. At the moment, even with the recovery stalling, there are no immediate plans for another round of monetary or fiscal stimulus from the Fed, the President, or the Congress. So what does it all mean as these major forces converge in the same week? Let's get two views that may sometimes converge and sometimes not from Simon Johnson, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and co-founder of his blog, The Baseline Scenario, and Nicole Gelinas, a contributing editor at the Manhattan Institute City Journal and author of After the Fall, Saving Capitalism from Wall Street and Washington. Welcome back, both of you. Hi, Simon. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, how are you?
Good morning, Brian. Good morning, Simon.
And we'll get to Greece shortly, but I actually want to start in this country where a lot of people woke up and saw the lead headlines on their mobile phones or their websites or their newspapers coming from the business pages that Bank of America is nearing this $8.5 billion settlement with investors who claim they were defrauded into buying mortgage-backed securities before the bubble burst. Does this mean Bank of America is admitting, Simon, that there was widespread false information about the health of the bundled mortgage investments when the bunders actually believed they were teetering?
I don't think they're admitting anything, but they're certainly conceding very big mistakes were made. And this is a major reversal for Brian Moynihan, the CEO of Bank of America, who previously said he would be engaging in hand-to-hand combat with investors to prevent having to make this kind of payout.
And, Nicole, many economists seem to say this kind of settlement is so important that it's what's needed before a real sustained recovery can take place in the broader economy. When the banks resolve the real value of these toxic mortgages, like through these kinds of settlements, that begins to resolve the real value of homes in America, which gets credit flowing again to the housing market and elsewhere, which gets the broader economy flowing again. Do you accept that sequence of events?
I think that's partly true, but it should have happened a long time ago. We are still, you know, really half a decade almost into the housing crisis. We are still talking about the value of mortgage securities. The actual mortgages that are in these securities cocooned through many, many layers from reality, the mortgages still have not been written down where to any realistic level. All we've done with the underlying mortgages is the government has encouraged the lenders to extend the terms, tack on defaulted principal to the end of the mortgage, extend teaser rate interest rates for longer. We haven't done the big write-downs of the amount that is owed on the mortgages that really has to happen. So the settlement is a tiny little step in the right direction, but we don't have another half decade to sort of skirt around this problem.
Simon, you agree with that?
Yes, I agree with the points Nicole's making. I would add that presumably other big banks face similar problems now and similar settlements to what Bank of America has just gone through. And I'm very worried about the lack of capital in those banks. They fund themselves with a lot of debt and very little shareholder equity. They've been allowed by the Federal Reserve to pay out large dividends to their shareholders, and they're not well prepared for any kind of settlement. So well-capitalized banks could exactly go through the process that Nicole outlined and come through healthier and supporting economic growth, the kinds of banks we have right now, particularly our big banks, are not well prepared for these settlements.
I gather this settlement is really about Countrywide Financial, the subprime lender that Bank of America acquired during the 2008 financial crisis when Countrywide was going down. How many more settlements like this with how many other banks, Nicole, would it take to get to the place where you say we should have gotten to already, where the underlying toxic asset problem, the real value of homes, is about to be resolved?
Well, if you think about the mortgages that are somewhere underneath there, we went into the housing bubble before 9/11 with about $5 trillion in mortgage debt outstanding around the case, around the country. By 2007, early 2007, we had doubled that. We had more than $10.6 trillion worth of mortgage debt that people owed on their houses. And since then, we've only knocked off 5% of that number. We're still above $9.9 trillion worth of mortgage debt. And a lot of those mortgages are wrapped up into these securities. Problem is, a lot of these securities are still rated AAA. So more aggressive principal write-downs would mean more downgrades of AAA securities. Regulators don't want to see that, as Simon mentioned. The banks don't want to see that, partly because the banks own the second mortgages. If you touch the first mortgages, a lot of these second mortgages, home equity loans, they will be worth a lot less than the banks say they are, and the banks have got these second mortgages right on their books. So we're still kind of in this holding pattern. And it really, you know, you go back to the fall of 2008, you remember TARP's original idea was to buy these toxic securities from the banks. It turned out it would take too long, too complicated, and they weren't worth very much. Those problems are still there. It's still taking too long, it's still too complicated, and they're still not worth very much. We've just delayed it for a long time.
Simon, do you think this settlement will become an industry standard quickly to move things forward?
I think there will be more settlements following this. This is a model for the so-called private putbacks, which involve lenders, entirely private transaction. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were not involved in this. And up to this point, there's been some contention about whether there was a liability on the part of the lenders, the originators, and the servicers, which Bank of America represents, as you say, because they bought Countrywide. Now I think it's going to be harder for people to say there's no liability here. So, yes, you should expect other big settlements and a hit to the capital of those banks. And again, you have to ask, why hasn't the Federal Reserve really pushed to prepare the banks for either the kinds of settlements we're talking about or the kinds of write-downs that Nicole is advocating and I think rightly suggesting still lie ahead of us?
So, Nicole, if this settlement implies that Countrywide defrauded people, will anyone go to prison for that?
Well, we'll see. I'm not the first person to point out that we haven't seen high-level executive prosecutions. And honestly, that doesn't bother me too much. I mean, of course, people who committed fraud should certainly be prosecuted and go to prison. But I think in the past, in cases like Enron, you know, in many other cases, people have focused too much on, gee, if we can find this one greedy guy and throw him in prison, we're going to fix things and make everyone safe. Didn't turn out to be true. I think we need the regulatory fixes even more than we need the criminal side. We've got to get the derivatives onto clearinghouses, get them well capitalized, make sure you don't have a lot of custom derivatives hidden on the bank's books where they're not really parts of a market. They're snowflakes. No bank wants any derivative to be compared to any other. Get the banks capitalized and you'll fix things on the civil side. The criminal side is good for justice, of course, but not the main thing in fixing the financial system.
Simon, same question.
I think there's nothing that concentrates the mind quite like the prospect of being prosecuted for crimes and the potential jail time. But I agree with Nicole, it's very unlikely to happen in the aftermath of this crisis and pretty unlikely going forward given the legal frameworks we have. And I agree also that the big regulatory fixes have really not been put in place. And I would emphasize the importance of capital. The capital requirements that have been reaffirmed and expanded or stated more explicitly for very large financial institutions, the latest information we got on that was this weekend, these are very, very low. And this is, of course, why we're worried about Greece and other potential big shocks around the world, because these can come and impact the heart of our financial system, where the banks do not have a lot of equity financing. They do not have big buffers against losses, and therefore they're vulnerable to exactly the same sorts of problems they encountered after the failure of Lehman Brothers.
We're talking about three big-ticket items on the economy converging in the news in this 48-hour period with Simon Johnson from MIT, Nicole Gelinas from the Manhattan Institute. Our phones are open for both questions and comments at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post it to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show, and let's move on to the vote in Greece. Simon, what's your understanding of what's in this bill that did now pass the Greek parliament just a short time ago, and what does it mean?
Well, the Greek government seems to have been able to pass some of the austerity measures that the European Union was asking for, measures that in return should unlock a further disbursement of the existing loan to Greece. But I'm afraid this is far from over. There's going to be more cliffhangers both at the European level and at the Greek level, because Greece needs a lot more money if it is to stay reasonably viable and avoid some sort of disorderly restructuring or default on its debt. So this story is going to run and run.
Well, Nicole, what does it mean for the United States? Because the New York Times had an article, which I guess is now dated since they passed it, in the business section today, that warned of ripple effects all the way to money market funds in the U.S. if they didn't pass it. And people put their money in money markets when they don't want to take risks, obviously. Many of those money markets, I believe, became insured after the financial crisis began in 08. But the article still warned of a worst-case scenario where investors would start pulling their funds and markets would seize up again. Is it overwrought hyperbole to raise that specter, in your opinion? And if not, does this vote in the Parliament of Greece today end it?
No, I don't think that it's overwrought hyperbole at all. The problem is these problems that we faced or that came to the surface in 2008, they're still there. They're just lurking not very far beneath the surface, which is that investors, they don't really trust the financial institutions' holdings of valuations of what they hold this sovereign debt for and so forth. These are mostly European financial institutions. But then the institutions rely on American money markets, really global money markets, for their short-term funding. And so you have the potential where a person or really an institution says, I don't want to take the risk tonight. I'm just going to keep my money somewhere else for a few days and we'll just see what happens. And so enough institutions do that around the world, and then you have another money market panic.
So how much does the acceptance of the austerity plan in Greece, while it's going to impose a lot of pain on a lot of people in Greece, stave that off?
Well, I don't. It's worrisome that Europe is approaching a problem of too much debt with more debt as the solution and more complex debt. They are really turning to complicated structured finance to try to solve these problems. We've seen the two stability facilities, enormously complex mechanisms to try to avoid Germany, France, and the other countries having to put a blanket guarantee on this Greece debt. And you see the same foolish things that you saw back in the heady days of the mortgage, that investors want to buy this rescue fund debt because they say it offers a little bit better return than German bonds, but it's not any riskier than German bonds. Well, it certainly is. Otherwise, it wouldn't be offering a better return. So we've made these problems even harder for people and citizens to understand, and we haven't fixed them. You see, it's not very complicated at all with the people protesting on the street. The problem really is one of too much debt. Privatizations are not going to work. Who is going to buy an asset in Greece denominated in euros? You have to borrow euros to buy it when it may not be denominated in euros in a couple of years. So these are just stopgap measures, really.
And Simon, what do you make of the ferocity of the demonstrations amid the extreme pressure from financial markets? On the one hand, we have banks and governments and editorial boards celebrating this austerity plan today. And on the other hand, we have workers furious that this failure of government and the markets is being taken out on them. Do the average people and the elites just not get each other?
I don't think anyone's celebrating austerity, Brian. And the question is, what are the alternatives, and how much austerity would Greece have to do if it were to cut itself off from financial markets and from European Union assistance at this point? And the answer to that is almost certainly they would do more austerity to hurt more people. On the other hand, the people in the streets also have a point, which is that when you have a boom, lots of relatively well-off people did extremely well in Greece, and now the austerity measures they feel are being disproportionately targeted towards relatively poor people. There is always a distributional fight going on behind both the boom and the bust, and Greece is no exception to that point.
Let's take a call on the toxic assets. Mike in Huntington, you're on WNYC. You're a mortgage broker?
I was. I'm not anymore.
Okay.
In regards to the toxic assets, I'm just calling from more of an aspect of the banks finally, you know, taking some responsibility for it. I mean, it's completely ridiculous. I mean, when I was a mortgage broker, I was a broker from in 06 and 07, and basically what it boiled down to was just a mill. It was a mill of them pumping as many mortgage brokers into the company as possible, and then pulling leads, and then the leads were from people that were getting multiple calls. I mean, these people had already been called 5 times in one day in regards to the same issue. I mean, you couldn't even get 2 words out, and they would be like, please leave me alone. So, you know, there should be, you know, responsibility, or there should be, like, people taking their blame on multiple sides of this. I mean, it's completely ridiculous. The brokerage houses, the banks, everything. Now that that doesn't exist anymore, I do feel like the banks at least taking some form of responsibility for this. At least it makes the American people feel like, all right, well, you know, geez, at least there's some liability, finally.
Mike, thank you very much. I think a lot of people share your anger. Now, listeners, let's talk about the convergence of these three big global economic events in a 48-hour period: the apparent Bank of America settlement on toxic assets, the vote in Greece, and the end of QE2. This can be abstract stuff, and I realize that, and I hope we're clarifying it well for you non-economists in the audience, and I think there are one or two of you. And we're getting two different views on all of it from Simon Johnson and Nicole Gelinas. So call if you work in finance, call if you don't, call with your opinions, call with your questions, call with your anger, call with your curiosity, call from left, right, or other. It's all welcome. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. In a minute, we'll continue and add the third piece of the puzzle, the end tomorrow of Ben Bernanke's quantitative easing 2, QE2, and we'll see if these forces are converging to make this week some kind of economic turning point with these three things happening at the same time. 212-433-WNYC, or post your question or comment to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. More in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we talk about three potentially huge developments in the economy taking place in this 48-hour period with global implications: the Bank of America toxic mortgages settlement, the vote in Greece on the bailout and austerity plan, and the end of quantitative easing, with Simon Johnson from MIT and Nicole Gelinas from the Manhattan Institute. And let's move on to QE2. Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve Board's quantitative easing program, which ends tomorrow, June 30th. Remind us, Nicole, what did the Fed actually do in this program? What will actually stop happening after tomorrow?
Well, the Fed usually focuses on short-term securities, you know, constantly buying and selling shorter-dated Treasury securities in order to have an effect on interest rates. If you want interest rates to be low, you buy these securities, you buy them with cash, flood cash into the market, and interest rates go down. They decided that wasn't enough, so they went out into the longer-dated securities market, trying to push long-term interest rates down. You know, 30-year bond rates they want down. Why do they want bond rates down? Because that pushes mortgage rates down, hopefully one of the ways that that happens, and so more people can buy houses. It also allows financial institutions to borrow for a long time at very low interest rates, and buy up some of these financial assets, stocks, bonds, including some of these mortgage-backed securities, push the value of all those things up as well. So basically, they've conjured up cash out of nowhere. They're allowed to do that and use that to buy long-dated securities, pushing more money into the market.
So this program has supporters who say all that money and all that credit gave a boost to the economy seen in the stock market and the beginning of job growth. Detractors say it didn't succeed in lowering long-term rates that much or create very many jobs, and it just set the stage for inflation, weakened the dollar by increasing the supply of dollars so much, and even contributed to world hunger, critics say, through the global spike in world food prices because investors fled from dollars to commodities. Here is Ben Bernanke himself supporting the program and defending from the critics.
The conclusion that the second round of securities purchases was ineffective could only be validated if one thought that this step was a panacea, that it was going to solve all the problems and return us to full employment overnight. So again, relative to what we expected and anticipated, I think the program was successful.
So Simon Johnson, do you come down on one side or another?
I don't think the program had that much impact. It did probably help move up asset prices. It perhaps contributed to these very, very easy credit conditions, actually, certainly for a lot of corporate borrowers. High yield rates have been at record historic lows. But it's very hard to keep this sort of thing up because people start to worry about inflation. They start to worry about the sustainability of the program, and that pushes interest rates in the other direction. And I think ultimately employment growth is anemic, mostly because of the kinds of problems we've been talking about so far in the sense of housing, the overhang of debt on the consumer sector, particularly mortgage debt. Those are the big problems, and those are not easily fixed just by trying to pull down 10-year Treasury rates to artificial lows.
Nicole, you were one of many mostly conservative finance experts who signed a letter to Bernanke opposing QE2 when it was about to start, weren't you? And what did you warn them then of, and what do you think now?
Well, you know, speaking only for myself, I think the problem is it's like if you're playing a sport and you get an injury, you get a cortisone shot. It allows you to play through the injury, but maybe it's not a good idea to play through the injury. Maybe there's the pain is trying to tell you something that you are doing more damage in anesthetizing yourself against it. Same thing here. We have a financial industry that has continued to play right on through the economy's injury, making enormous profits up until the last quarter of last year. Now they've started to slow, bond yields going down, institutions being able to borrow very cheaply, but we haven't fixed the underlying problems, and we may very well be making them worse as they sit there and fester longer and longer. The more that a person lives in a house that they cannot afford and tries to make these mortgage payments, that is money that they're not saving for their kids' education, it's money that they're not saving for their own retirement, and it's money that they're not putting into the capital markets, stock bond markets, into more productive assets and creating jobs. So letting more good money go after bad, not a particularly good idea. And QE2, it enables the politicians and the regulatory side to ignore this problem for longer.
Very fancy cortisone shot analogy there, Nicole. I like it. And to that, from that, we will turn back to the phones. And Shelley in West Orange has a question about tying the toxic assets and the Greek debt crisis together. Hi, Shelley, you're on WNYC.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, exactly. It's something that I've been wondering about as far as, you know, our own fraudulent and terrible mortgage-backed products and how many European countries bought into them, including Greece, and are now in financial crisis as a result of that. And another comment that I heard today on the BBC is that now Greece is basically going to be in a situation where their national assets will be sold at fire sale prices. So, again, you know, who's going to benefit from this? And, okay, those are my two questions.
Okay, Shelley, thank you very much. So, Simon Johnson, should Greece be joining this investor lawsuit against Bank of America and Countrywide on the fraudulent sale of information around toxic assets?
I'm sure they'd be delighted to join the Sioux, but I don't think that there'd be any merit to that. The European banks did lend to these very bad mortgage products. That was more French banks, German banks, and some other, perhaps some Italian banks. The Greek banks' problem, unfortunately, comes almost entirely from the profligate fiscal policies of the Greek government. And the irony, of course, in all of this, as we mentioned before, is that our money market funds have an exposure to Greece, both directly, small one, and indirectly, much larger one, through their lending to other governments and bigger banks in the Eurozone. So I'm afraid it's much more along the lines of we fed the Greek debt habit in this particular instance, rather than the Greeks feeding our debt habit.
And what about her other question on who actually benefits and who actually feels pain in this Greek austerity deal? Simon.
Well, the pain will be felt by people lower down the income distribution, people with less education, people less able to get out of Greece, people with less of an understanding about how to take advantage of new opportunities, for example, fire sale prices. I think you can be sure that big global investment banks, such as Goldman Sachs, that helped Greece borrow a great deal of money, that are certainly accused of disguising the full extent of Greek indebtedness, banks such as Goldman Sachs are going to do just fine.
And it's so unfair, Nicole. That's what half the people who are calling in want to scream. It's so unfair. The worst pain that the banks feel is maybe extending the terms of credit for a longer period of time to Greece or something like that, rippling all the way down to here in New York, where in New York and New Jersey there's no appetite for shared sacrifice at the level of a millionaire's tax as it trickles down to fewer teachers in schools and all of that stuff, because the millionaires have everybody else over a barrel because they can just move to some other state with lower taxes. It just seems so unfair.
But with to get into the New York City side of things, the public sector benefited so much from this enormous bubble in New York City. Basically, for 25 years, from 1982 on, the city could afford guns and butter. We have lavish social services, lavish public sector wages, and particularly benefits. We have an army of a police force. We haven't skimped. We've doubled the education budget since the mayor took office, and that's something the mayor is proud of. He'll say every chance he can get that education spending is up 108%. This could not have happened without the Wall Street bubble. We did not have to make any choices for a quarter of a century, and now we have to make some choices. The problem is these $8.2 billion in pension benefits New York City spends every year. It is not affordable absent a permanent bubble. Millionaire's tax is not going to even start to address this problem. So the whole, when we hear from the public sector in New York, which is not very helpful, Wall Street caused this, Wall Street should pay. Wall Street caused their outside benefit scale in the first place.
But Simon, it's not just the public sector. It's all these people in the broader private economy losing their jobs after the bubble through the large impact of all of this. Is there no way to make the people on Wall Street feel more of the pain that was caused in large measure by Wall Street?
I don't think it's constructive to try to allocate pain in that way. There are many people on Wall Street who are responsible professionals who actually are working hard to do reasonable things. And I do think, by the way, that of all the places in the country, New York would be one of the places that will do relatively well, precisely because easy credit conditions will feed into the financial sector, and that will keep jobs relatively buoyant. I don't think this is really about punishing anyone. We should try and make our structures safer. We should try and prevent collapses in the future. We should ensure there's more equity financing for the financial sector and less debt relative to equity and relative to total assets. This idea that we can all borrow, governments, banks, individuals, we can borrow as much as we've done in the past, that idea really has to be reevaluated. And I think households are reducing the amount of debt they have outstanding. That's sensible. So are companies. Companies have moved to be much more cautious with their cash. And banks have to do the same thing.
Joel in Forest Hills, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joel.
Hi. I think we're still in a liquidity trap. Corporations are sitting on over $2 trillion in cash. Individuals and corporations are continuing paying down debt. The federal government is able to borrow money for 10 years out for less than 3%. And what I hear the economist saying is going back to classical economics, saying we should be paying down debt. And my thinking is, with rates so low and with no one spending money, velocity is going down in a big way, especially for middle class and poorer people. It makes a lot more sense for the federal government to issue an awful lot of debt and use fiscal policy and have the government, federal government, be an employer of last resort.
Joel, thank you. Go ahead, finish your thought.
I certainly disagree with that.
Thank you very much. So, Nicole, what about that? If the recovery is stalling, we don't see any monetary stimulus like a QE3 coming or any new fiscal policy stimulus like government spending or tax cuts. So is Washington deciding that it has played all its economic cards, even as this new slump drags on? And to Joel's point, if interest rates are so historically low, maybe even though we all recoil from more debt, this is a historic opportunity to borrow more money to help stimulate the economy because the interest rates are just so darn low.
Well, I think he makes a couple of interesting points in there. One on stimulus. What would the federal government be borrowing all this cheap money for? Presumably for stimulus. And I think, you know, the president had such an opportunity with the stimulus in early 2009 and really poisoned it. That if you read the original polls, you know, Wall Street Journal does these quarterly polls, very detailed, something like 85% of people supported spending money on things like fixing up roads, bridges, tunnels, infrastructure, building school buildings, all of that stuff. That is not a bad idea. You know, if materials costs are low, labor costs are theoretically low, and you can build more infrastructure for less money right at the time when you do need to create some jobs, nothing wrong with doing that. The problem is the White House just listened to these economists who said it doesn't matter what you spend the money on, just get it out there. And so you sent a third of the stimulus to local and state governments, spent it on maintaining too high education and medical operating spending, too high public sector wages and benefits, no transition where they said, okay, you can use this money for the emergency, but you've got to show that you can get these costs down in the future. And people said this is not what we wanted the money to go toward. We wanted it to go toward investment in infrastructure, and it didn't. And so we don't want to see more stimulus. And it's a huge wasted opportunity.
Simon, same question.
Joel, the caller made good points. So the problem is that we didn't have a responsible fiscal policy coming in to the crisis. If we had run U.S. fiscal policy, as some other countries around the world have done, very carefully pre-crisis, there would have been more space for stimulus, subject to the very good constraints that Nicole laid out. In other words, you need to have sensible things to spend on. You need to do things that people can recognize as sensible investments. But I think there's plenty of investments, there's plenty of repairs that can be done on the roads around New York, for example, that would make complete sense. But the problem is we already had a lot of debt. And for 20, and this is bipartisan debt, I would emphasize, both from the Clinton administration and from the Bush administration, there was a repeated refusal to deal with the deeper underlying fiscal problems of the country. Now the fiscal problems are more apparent to people. Now perhaps they're overly panicked about them. But nevertheless, they're right to worry about the extent of debt and the rate at which the debt increases due to the deficit. So you can't just wish the government could go out and employ everybody who needs a job. That's not going to work when you've been running irresponsible fiscal policy for 20 to 30 years.
You know, we had the two of you on today because, in part, besides that you're just really smart, knowledgeable people, that, Simon, I think your reputation is you tend to lean a little more left on a lot of these issues. Nicole, you lean a little more right. You guys have agreed a lot. Are you representative of a consensus out there of, I don't know, of expert opinion that's different from the polarized political opinion that we hear in a lot of media? Simon?
I would say yes. I think when I talk to people outside of Washington, on issues around the financial sector, I find the right and the left agree. I was on a panel recently with Alan Meltzer from Carnegie Mellon and Joe Stiglitz from Columbia talking about too big to fail, the dangers of very big banks and their behavior and what caused the crisis and the dangers we face going forward. And Alan is from the right. Joe is more from the left. I would say I'm more in the middle. Anyway, we all agreed on the issues, and I think if we got into them with Nicole, we would also agree. The problem is within Washington, there is no agreement between left and right.
Nicole, same question, and we're out of time.
Yes, as a conservative, I think it's important that free markets work. Right now, we have no free markets in the financial sector, and we really haven't for 30 years. I mean, this goes back to 1984 when we christened our first too-big-to-fail bank. We still have this problem. The problem is politically, it's also very abstract at this point. You know, you watch the Republican presidential debate. No one is talking about the financial crisis. They seem to think it's over, and I think part of it is that Washington, and this goes for Congress as well, home prices aren't down in Washington. People don't feel trapped in their mistakes from the bubble. And it's, you know, feeling that viscerally, like people are feeling that in Florida, Nevada, Arizona, even New York, where we have the lowest percentage of people who owe more on their houses, but they owe a lot more when they are underwater. People don't feel that in Washington. And they are afraid of upsetting the big banks.
Nicole Gelinas from the Manhattan Institute City Journal and author of After the Fall, Saving Capitalism from Wall Street in Washington, and Simon Johnson, former chief economist of the IMF, professor at MIT, and co-founder of the Baseline Scenario blog. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We have John Prendergast next. Maybe you know him from his partnerships with international celebrity do-gooders like George Clooney and Angelina Jolie. He has written a fascinating book, and we will talk about conditions in the United States and Africa. John Prendergast coming up next.